This is Audible.
Mask of the Template, a monster girl harem fantasy. Celestine Chronicles Book 1. Written by Sibelius. Narrated by Tess Irondale. Chapter 1. Bad Ending.
Listen to me, Mac. I got a lot of money riding on this, so let's keep it simple. Crush this guy and you and your sister are free to go. You lose, and she'll be scrubbing my toilets and sucking the chrome off my tailpipe long after you're dead and buried. Now, go get him, kid.
Terry slipped two rapid-fire punches as he measured the distance with a quick left, then struck hard with the right and closed in. He locked his hands against his opponent's head, jerking him down into a rising knee. Blood spattered across Terry's face as the man staggered back, semi-conscious, nose broken. He followed, landing a quick combination to the gut and then turning with all his might into a spinning back fist that caught his opponent across the temple and sent him staggering away to slam against the cage where he sagged, then fell. The ref stepped in between the two fighters, but Terry was already walking away. He raised a taped fist in a pro forma gesture toward the roaring crowd that surrounded the cage, but he couldn't see anyone or anything past the glare of lights that shone down on him from every direction.
I can't believe I'm here. Can't believe she got caught up with a mobster. Can't believe she caught me up with him. I won't make a dime off this fight.
He came back to the center, waiting patiently. They cleaned up the other man, and the two stood on either side of the announcer, who in due course raised Terry's hand. He nodded, not even bothering to take his mouthpiece out. He had nothing to say. Another roar from the crowd, and with an adroit leap, Terry caught the top of the fence and hauled himself over and out, dropping onto the lane cleared for him. Pats on the back followed him into the locker room, but he didn't know these people, didn't care. All he wanted now was his sister and the door. 5 fights in 5 nights with no recovery time and very little sleep. He needed food. Truth be told, he probably needed a doctor. He suspected at least 2 of his ribs were fractured, and his own nose had been broken on the 3rd night and poorly set. He had deep purple bruises all over his body, and he'd had to sleep in hidden corners like a vagrant to keep hired thugs from crippling him in a bid to fix the fights. These underground tournaments were big money, but Terry knew he'd be lucky if he didn't have another fight coming, just to make the boss he'd been forced to work for pay his dues.
Then again, I've got more than just luck going for me tonight.
If he hadn't been so hurt and so pissed, he might have smiled. One way or another, this shit would end.
No one messes with my family. They may be just about worthless, but they're all I've got.
The locker room reeked of stale sweat and moldy towels. Boss man Voight was waiting for him, along with 4 of his bodyguards, and Lisa. Terry immediately knew something was wrong. Lisa was draped across Voight as though she were a trophy wife. The mobster was smiling brightly, though Terry knew enough by now to recognize that the smile was skin deep.
So, you did good, kid. You paid off your sister's debt. This is the part where I'm supposed to pull something crude. You beat me and everyone else in the room up, then escape with your grateful sibling. Roll credits, right?
His thugs chuckled as Terry's fists tightened, but he forced himself to relax again as he said,
Got an option B? Beating up all your thugs sounds like a lot of work. Huh, well, actually, I say we go with your sister's idea. What do you say, Lisa?
Voight wrapped a hand around her, and she snuggled in as Terry trembled with barely suppressed fury. His eyes found hers, and the sparkle in them dimmed a bit as she glanced away, then looked again, defiance in every line of her face as she said,
I'm staying. I like it with Ben. He's been good to me. The last week has been better than anything you or anyone else ever gave me. I'm not throwing it away.
You can't be serious. I'm not taking you back to Dad. I wouldn't do that after...
She made a chopping gesture to interrupt Terry and said, I don't care about that. Not anymore. Dad selling me off was the best thing that ever happened to me. I'm sorry you felt you had to go through this, but I never asked for you to rescue me.
Never asked?
Terry stared at her in confusion.
You think I'd wait for you to ask? You think I'd just let some pusher take you away?
Well, I didn't. She glared at him. Go home or go away. There's no debt anymore. I can come and go as I please, so thanks.
There's no debt because I fought for you. If you wanted to stay, why didn't you tell me before I risked my fucking life to get you out of here?
Rage and confusion suffused Terry as he watched his sister curl back into Voight's embrace, glaring at him.
She doesn't even look guilty anymore. She played me as much as Voight did.
He couldn't help but notice the glint of diamonds in her ears and around her throat. It was obvious what was going on, at least to him. How could his sister not see it? Voight leaned down and kissed the golden curls atop Lisa's head, before shifting her back behind him and spreading his hands. The four men flanking him spread out and drew back their coats to reveal pistols couched in waistbands, as the mob boss said,
So, there you have it. I like this ending better. This is the part where you grab your shit and get out. I'll even pay you bill if you check into the hospital before dawn as a thank you for making me what is quite frankly an astonishing amount of money. Five fights in five nights? I mean, come on, T, you're a beast. I'd never have thought a coal miner's son could really go the distance. Sure you don't want to work for me? I can pay you way more than you're making slaving away in the circuit, getting conned by one promoter after another. Fuck you, Voight. How many kids OD'd for those diamonds on her neck, huh? How many bodies bought the ones in her ears?
The mobster shrugged.
C'est la vie. I'm impressed, so I'll give you an out. Get to the hospital, and as they fix you up, you can wonder how much product I shifted to pay your bills. Do anything else?
His fake smile vanished. The sneer that replaced it was obviously more his speed.
Do anything else? And the only medical treatment I pay for you to get will be a lead cranial injection.
Terry didn't know whether to laugh or cry. As he trembled, struggling to contain his rage, he heard the tenor of the crowd's roar change, heard people beginning to panic. Over the crowds, faint but growing louder, was the unmistakable sound of police sirens.
Finally, finally they're here.
Voight's eyes flickered past him toward the door leading out toward the cage, and the attention of his bodyguards wavered as well. Terry saw a chance and took it. He lunged toward the man on his right and got to him before he could draw. Terry's punch caught him in the throat an instant before his knee crashed into the thug's privates. He pulled the gun from the downed man's waistband and aimed at Voight, but the mobster jerked Lisa in front of him to shield himself from Terry's bullet. She shrieked as Terry shifted his aim to the second gunman, but the pistol wouldn't fire. Time seemed to slow as he watched the other man flick the safety on his weapon, then pull the trigger. The fiery bloom of the bullet leaving the barrel should have been the last thing Terry saw in his life. It wasn't. Chapter 2. Why's it always gotta be a cave? The sound of waves crashing against rocks gradually brought Terry back to consciousness. He stirred, felt the damp sand beneath him. The unmistakable scent of the ocean finally convinced him to open his eyes, and he sat up. The light was dim by contrast with the brightness beyond the mouth of the small cave in which he found himself. Behind him there was a rough rock wall, and he sat on a narrow bar of sand that curled around him and out past the lip of the cave. Blue-green water rose and receded not more than a foot from him, and beyond the entrance, the bright light of the sun shone down on a distant ridge of rock in the water, a few hundred yards away. His first thought was that he'd died and gone to heaven,
There was no hint of pollution in the air or in the water, and he felt no pain. Gingerly, he examined himself and found no trace of bruising. The ribs he'd been convinced were cracked no longer pained him. He felt at his nose and found that it was whole, though he could tell it had been broken and reset. It was when he felt at his forehead that thoughts of heaven faded. There was a blaze of scar tissue, about an inch above his gray-green eyes, almost centered on his forehead.
So I was shot, in the head. Why am I not dead, then? Somehow I don't think I'd have scars in heaven.
A more thorough examination of his body showed him that new scars weren't the only ones he'd kept. There was a long gash across the top of his right thigh that he'd gotten from a fall off the roof a few years back, and other nicks and cuts picked up from a rough life lived half on the streets were all still very much in evidence as scars across his arms and torso, each a reminder of a mistake or of being in the wrong place at the wrong time. He ran his hand over his head and found that, too, was just as he remembered. His black hair was shaved almost to the skin on the sides and back and was too short to grip on top. He had a bit of stubble on his face, but no more than a day's worth. He was still dressed in the blue and green trunks he'd fought his last fight in, and in fact, his hands and feet were still taped. Unfortunately, there was no trace of the gun or of anything else. His gym bag with his phone, wallet, even his shoes was nowhere in evidence. Terry stood, stretched, and looked around again bemusedly as he dusted the damp sand off his limbs. His circumstances were so far beyond any rational explanation that he quit trying to think of what must have happened to bring him here, and, stepping carefully along the edge of the water, left the cave, shielding his eyes against the bright sunlight outside.
Man, I don't think I've ever seen a sky so blue.
He was on a beach. Glancing behind him revealed that he stood at the edge of a line of cliffs that rose up and away to the south. The tops of the cliffs were at least 300 feet above the waves, but near him they were only about 30 feet high, and petered out into foothills to his left. With the sea to his right, the beach ahead of him was pure white sand for a good 30 feet, before rising into rough sand dunes held in place by scrub brush. The temperature felt like it was in the high 60s to low 70s, and there was a stiff breeze gusting in off the water.
Maybe not heaven, but I'm pretty sure I've seen postcards that weren't this pretty.
He started to walk down the beach, more for lack of any better ideas than any specific thought of getting somewhere. He looked out toward the sea wall of rock again, and noticed, now that he had a wider view, that there were people out there. They seemed to be relaxing in various attitudes, but there was no way his voice would carry that far across the pounding surf. He waved, but they didn't seem to be aware of him yet, and so he resumed his walk. The cliffs receded behind him, and after about a quarter mile, he noticed that there were people swimming toward him.
I guess they spotted me after all.
He paused and turned, waiting for them to get to him. Three women got to their feet in the shallows and approached, but as they did so, he began warily backing away. It was clear at a glance that none of them were human. Sunlight glinted off more than water droplets. Their lower legs seemed to be entirely scaled, and scales striped their abdomens and arms. One had silver scales, and the other two had scales that seemed to be a mixture of green and gold. Their hair was uniformly black, and what flesh he could see was darkly tanned. Their breasts were demurely covered with seashell bikinis, but none of them had anything covering their lower bodies. The women paused at the edge of the surf and stared at him, each tilting her head this way and that, as though to gaze at a curious creature. He got the distinct impression that he was as odd-looking to them as they were to him. The silver-scaled one began to sing, and the other two picked up the wordless tune a moment later, harmonizing perfectly. It was a lovely sound, and Terry smiled despite himself as he listened. It was a wordless aria that fit in perfectly with the sound of the surf, and time seemed to slip by unnoticed as Terry listened to their sounds. His mind drifted, and thoughts came and went unnoticed as he focused on the beautiful song. One of them beckoned to him as she sang, but her alien appearance snapped him out of his reverie and kept him at bay. He blinked hard and shook his head. He enjoyed their song, but his native caution, graven deep into his soul by the rough life that he'd lived, kept his feet firmly planted where they were. He also noticed that there were other people out in the ocean, heads bobbing as they stayed in deeper water, observing him.
Not a single one of them looks human.
Terry recalled the story of Odysseus, and was powerfully reminded of the sirens from that story, luring men to their deaths with the power of their song. His wariness went up another several notches as he took a step back. The singing stopped, and one of the three women turned to the others and said, "He isn't entranced. Something is wrong." Another pointed as she said, "Look at his hands and feet. Look at his ears and eyes. I think he's a template."
"Template?"
he asked.
"I'm human. What are you?"
When he spoke to them, all three seemed both startled and excited. "He is. He speaks our language. He's a template. Sisters, it's a template. Call for Cecilia." There was a murmuring, loud enough to be heard over the waves, as the crowd gathered out in the water spoke amongst themselves. Several of the heads dipped under the water and out of sight. The silver-scaled woman took another step forward and beckoned Terry again as she said,
"There's nothing to fear. We only want to touch you, to spend some time with you. Won't you come to us?"
Terry looked down and noticed that her feet were still in the water, and began to suspect that these creatures wouldn't be able to leave the surf, or at least wouldn't be comfortable doing so. All three of the women were pretty, in a weird sort of way, but there were simply too many warning bells going off. He waited to see if she would come any closer. Instead, one by one, the heads bobbing out in the waves vanished, and a new face appeared. As she rose from the surf, Terry's eyes widened in shock. Instead of legs, she carried herself forward on the lower body of an octopus, the many black tentacles writhing as she moved with an unnatural smoothness to stand at the edge of the surf. She had pale skin, unlike the tan skin of the scaled women who'd first approached him, and her features were aristocratic, somehow. Her black hair hung to her waist, and her bangs were hooked back behind long, pointed ears.
"Won't you come?"
this new woman asked, stretching out a hand to him.
"We truly mean you no harm. No woman on all of Celestine would wish you ill."
"I think not."
Terry gestured aimlessly over his shoulder at the dunes behind him.
"Need to go that way. Thanks for the song. It was nice."
A cascade of feminine protestations chased him up the beach and into the dunes, but he didn't look back, and they didn't chase him. 50 yards took him past the dunes at the edge of the beach, and he glanced left and right. The land to the left rose up and away, and Terry could see the dark line of a forest that way. He stood on sandy dirt now, with grass that grew in patches almost to waist height, along with the strangely twisted scrub brush that had begun in the dunes. To the right and away in front of him were rolling grasslands, and after a moment's hesitation and a glance back to ensure no one followed him or watched from the dunes, he turned right. He was beginning to get thirsty and needed to find water. He didn't know much about geography, but thought it more likely he'd find a river if he stayed in the lowlands. The sand was beginning to chafe at his feet, and he paused long enough to take the tape off, though he didn't discard the wraps. He had literally nothing but what he wore, and he wasn't about to throw anything away that he didn't have to. The wraps could be reused, and he might need them for something else later, so he wound them loosely around his neck to keep them out of his way as he began to jog north. At least, he thought it was north, given the sun was over the ocean and looked to be tracking higher toward the land. Morning, then. Somewhere between 9 and 10?
Not that it matters. I've got nowhere to be.
He wondered what he was supposed to do now. Aside from his meager belongings, he felt no pressing need to go home. After all, his parents had sold one of their daughters for cash, a daughter who had in turn sold him out at the first chance. He had friends, but after high school there'd been no hope of college without money, and he'd been moving from one manual labor job to the next to finance his time in three dojos across the city, hoping to get a professional booking and move up from there. The five consecutive fights he'd been forced to win had solidified his opinion of his own ability, but now that he was here, all that training seemed a bit of a waste. He had a high school education, peak physical conditioning, and knew how to brawl, but that was pretty much it. He didn't have any outdoor survival skills and was fairly sure there wouldn't be any supermarkets in his immediate future.
It'd freaking suck if there were, come to think of it. I'm broke. I don't even have my crap-ass phone.
The thought that the sea people might feed him crossed his mind, but he felt that was a chance best left to last. They weren't human, and despite what they'd told him, Terry was too jaded to believe that they meant him no harm. Everyone always had an angle, and the only thing you could really count on with other people was that they'd serve their own self-interest first. Terry manifestly had nothing to offer in trade, which meant that if they wanted him, it was probably as prey.
Don't want to be eaten, and I'm done being used. Fuck that noise.
He tried not to think about that last woman, the one with the lower body of an octopus. That shit would be giving him nightmares. He made decent time and covered what he estimated to be about 4 miles, before the land in front of him dipped and turned sandy again. He paused at the edge of what turned out to be a vast estuary, at least a couple miles wide, and glanced around. To the west, a broad river cut through the hills, before breaking up into rivulets interspersed with mud and sandbars, some big enough to be topped with grass, others not. As he looked west, he thought he could make out a rising column of smoke, and turned to head that way, though he backed away from the edge of the estuary, not wanting to be seen before he had a chance to do some recon himself. After running into fish people, he wasn't keen on being surprised again. A 1/4 mile brought him to a small hill that he crested cautiously, crouching behind a low shrub to look down on what turned out to be a primitive fishing village of huts clustered at the near bank of the river. The buildings were built on stilts and seemed to be primarily constructed of reeds and grass. There were people working throughout the area, and it was readily apparent after a moment's examination that these folk weren't human either. The tails were what gave it away, though most of them also had furred extremities and other odd bits about them. They weren't all women, either, unlike all the fish folk that had talked to him. It looked like about half and half, though, and that seemed a little odd. Terry seemed to remember from history class that during the westward migration, it was the women who caught the worst of it in terms of disease and disaster, and that the frontier had been pretty much male-dominated. The village was the very definition of primitive, so he'd expected more men than women. Then again, he knew fuck all about this place, other than that the nightmare fuel on the beach had called it Celestine. He settled down on his belly and continued to watch, trying to get a sense of these people. Most of them seemed to be of the same species or race, with broad tails and brown fur that covered their extremities. A few, though, seemed to be built differently, and seemed much larger. They had cloven hooves and short, thick horns, curling up from behind long, drooping ears. Even considering their much larger frames, Terry could tell from here that this second race were all ridiculously gifted in terms of feminine endowment. Despite their many differences, though, the people in the village below looked much more human than not. No tentacular horrors or other Lovecraftian weirdness.
Doesn't seem too bad. Maybe I can work for food and a place to spend the night.
Just as he'd resolved to go down and reveal himself, he spotted a group of villagers knee-deep in the water of the river, talking with several fish folk. The latter were gesturing toward the hills where he lay hidden, and word seemed to spread through the village like wildfire. Within another minute, people were leaving the village, headed toward him. Several had weighted fishermen's nets in hand.
Or I could back away and run like hell.
again.
Terry backed off the hill and began to jog south, heading as quickly as he dared for the forest. A shout went up behind him a few moments later, and he glanced back to see at least 6 people running after him. Throwing caution to the wind, he poured on the speed. The grass had to be avoided as it grew in hard clumps, and his stride was uneven as a consequence. But when he wasn't immediately caught, and 1 minute turned into 4, then 6, he dared a glance back and found to his surprise that he was easily outpacing the pursuit, with one notable exception. A woman with brown hair, bracketed by a pair of longhorns that could have come straight off the grill of a Cadillac, was gamely keeping pace with him. She must have been at least 6.5, maybe 7 feet tall, and took one step for every 3 of Terry's. She had no weapon, but she did carry a net slung over her shoulder. She was more than just tall, though. She was big, Herculean, in fact. With her great stature and cloven feet, she seemed able to ignore the grass entirely as she charged after him. She noticed him and waved, then shouted,
"Stop! We won't hurt you!"
"Then why the hell are you chasing me?"
He didn't waste breath asking. Instead, he lowered his head, poured on the speed, and ran hard for almost 20 minutes. When he reached the forest, he turned to look again. This time, there was no one behind him, though the rolling hills kept him from being able to see more than 0.5 mile back. He'd apparently managed to outdistance his pursuit. The majority of the natives in the village had looked to be shorter than he was, and their physiques had suggested they were at home close to the water, so he wasn't surprised they hadn't been able to run very fast. The others, that last pursuer included, had seemed more bovine. It didn't surprise him that one of them had been able to keep up for longer, but apparently he had more endurance.
"This place just keeps getting weirder and weirder. Aren't there any actual human beings around here? I mean, I'm here, right? So if I'm here, there must be others. What the hell am I going to do if I run into wolf people or tiger people? Something tells me outrunning them wouldn't be so easy."
Though he'd left them far behind, he wasn't willing to trust that they wouldn't try to track him, so he kept a jogging pace as he entered the trees. It was still late morning, so he pressed into the forest for 0.5 mile before slowing down to a walk. The ground under the trees was carpeted with loam, and the trees themselves were vast old things. There was very little undergrowth, but the roots of the trees were often gnarled and extended some distance from the bole, forcing Terry to be careful where he put his feet. Fortunately, perhaps, the old-growth forest was healthy and there wasn't much debris. He'd made something of a game of leaping from one root system to the next, in a rather half-baked effort to leave fewer tracks. Whether it would work or not was anyone's guess, but the going got notably harder as the land began to rise around him. He was often forced to use his hands as well as his feet to climb the slopes he encountered, and most of an hour went by before he finally paused to take a breather. He was at the crest of a rise and turned to look out over the land behind him. The forest's canopy had a gap here, and he was able to see all the way to the estuary due to the elevation. He narrowed his eyes in an effort to make out whether there was any pursuit, but if there was, he either couldn't see them or they'd already entered the forest. He wasn't sure which, but he rather hoped that they'd given up like the sea folk had. Then again, the sea folk looked unable to leave the water, so instead they'd spread the word, and the reaction had been pretty immediate.
"I really doubt they'll give up that easily. I just wish I knew why they thought it was worth chasing. I haven't got anything."
His stomach chose that moment to growl, and he'd been thirsty since before he found the village. Turning, he resumed his sojourn, hoping he would find a creek or something. He could see ahead of him that the cliffs, as tall as they were, fronted a mountain range that dwarfed them, so perhaps there would be water running down from the snow-capped peaks he could see in the hazy distance.
"I may not be a botanist, but I'm pretty sure forests like this don't grow without water."
Noon came and went as he moved through the ancient wood, but eventually he noticed that the incline had faded, and he now found himself on relatively flat ground. Curious, he turned and began making his way toward the coast. The roar and crash of the waves was deceptively distant as he reached the edge of the tree line and looked out over the water. From this high up, he could see that the seawall where the fish people had been sunning themselves extended as far as the horizon to the north, but petered out at around the same point that the cliffs he now stood on began to climb. There were no details he could make out, though, and he couldn't tell if the sea folk were still on the wall. Turning to look south, he saw that the cliffs continued to rise gradually in that direction for another mile, at least, before dipping suddenly into a valley, out of the center of which a great waterfall cascaded at least 500 feet into the ocean below.
There's the water I've been looking for. Let's hope this valley isn't full of monster people, too.
Destination now in mind, Terry slipped back into the trees and moved with a sense of purpose. Chapter 3. It's a Trap.
Well, so far so good. The valley is just as photogenic as the rest of this place. If I thought there was any real chance of getting back to Earth, which there certainly isn't, I'd wish I had a camera. Also deserted, which somehow is both surprising and makes me vaguely nervous.
Terry sat just back from the edge of the woods, staring out across the breadth of the valley. The whole thing was perhaps half a mile across, and the floor of the valley, where the river ran through, was about 50 feet lower than where he stood. A greensward dotted with wildflowers extended a couple hundred yards from the tree line to the river, and rose again on the far side up into more trees. Toward the head of the valley, younger trees seemed to have invaded the space, growing up around and obscuring the base of a waterfall that Terry could hear but not see from where he stood.
Why aren't the trees growing out there?
The sight and sound of the water made Terry's insides grumble, but his native caution kept him from leaving the trees. Something about the valley's sheer emptiness bothered him. The place was beautiful. Given a choice, he'd want to live there himself. So why wasn't anyone else here? It could be as simple as the fact that the people down on the plains weren't like him and preferred the lowlands. Then again, he'd seen fish people, octopus people, cow people, and what he'd begun to suspect were otter people. The idea that there weren't wolf people or bear people or deer people or any of innumerable other possibilities that would prefer a place like this stretched the bounds of credibility. So where were they? He swept the valley again with a careful gaze. Aside from the grass, there were wildflowers in white, pink, and red that seemed to grow out of creeping vines. No bushes, no young trees.
What am I missing?
Terry followed his instincts and turned west, staying under the forest canopy as he made his careful way toward the head of the valley. As the other side of the space came nearer, he finally caught sight of something that made him freeze. A deer, a normal deer, stood at the edge of the trees on the far side, looking down toward the water. It seemed to be alone, which was odd, but as he watched, it stepped out onto the greensward and began to amble down toward the water. As it stepped over one of the flowering vines, Terry's eyes widened as he saw the vine flex. Long tendrils curled up behind the deer. It startled and leapt away, but the entire field abruptly came alive as tentacular growths whipped up in a frenzy of movement. The deer was struck once, then again as it tried to flee. A vine whipped up in front of it, catching its front legs. It stumbled and fell. An instant later, the thrashing vines were coiling around it, and blood sprayed as innumerable cuts and wounds appeared across its hide, opened by thorns that seemed to shoot from the body of the vine, like the claws of a house cat when it flexed its paws. Within 30 seconds of entering the clearing, the animal was clearly dead, and its body seemed to pulse as the vegetation enfolded it, coiling and writhing in an orgy of movement. Terry's mouth hung open as he stared, then looked again at the near side of the valley. Not 10 feet away, the creeping vine seemed to peter out at the base of a big tree. He stood only a few feet away from a deadly predator. His eyes flickered back out toward the deer, in time to see the vines carrying the bulk along to the water. What it dumped out looked like a desiccated husk of skin and bones that the water carried away and out of sight. The vines rustled for a few moments, and then were still once more. Only because he knew where the kill had occurred was Terry able to spot the blood on the grass.
That could have been me. This place is a horror show.
Staying well within the trees and watching the ground for any sign of the predatory plant, Terry continued to move toward the waterfall that fed the deadly valley. If he hadn't been looking out for vines on the ground all around, he'd have missed the body. It was more of a skeleton, really. Obviously long dead and with virtually all the skin gone. Rotted bits of cloth hung from the frame, and the lower limbs were scattered between the trees, many of the larger bones cracked open and gnawed upon. The skull and hands made it clear that whatever this thing had been, human wasn't it. The hands were larger than they should have been, and the fingers ended in claws, while the skull itself had a muzzle. The lower body was too scattered to make any other conclusions, but the remains were a mute testament to the perils that lay in silent wait only a few feet away.
He must have managed to drag himself out, but died of his wounds.
Terry swept the area around the body and found a sturdy 6-foot-long spear with a well-worn haft of wood that was so dark as to be almost black. The blade of the spear was iron or steel. Terry had no way to know which for sure. It showed traces of rust, but the weapon wasn't too degraded. It was certainly a world better than the nothing he currently had. He also found the remains of a backpack under the upper body of the skeleton, but the only things within that hadn't been either eaten or rotted beyond any use were a spoon, a double-bladed dagger about 12 inches long with a full tang and yellowed bone handle, and in the remains of a rotten pouch he found a flat gray stone about 8 inches long and 2 wide that he suspected was flint, along with a curved piece of metal that almost fit his hands like brass knuckles would have fit if his hands had been twice their current size.
Flint and steel, right? So in theory, if I knew what the hell I were doing, I could make a fire.
Supplies and weapons were well and good, but there was still a problem. Terry wore fighting trunks. He didn't even have a shirt, much less pockets. The only thing he had that might let him carry something and keep his hands free was the tape he'd unwound from his feet, and he wasn't sure exactly how to make it work. He tried picking the backpack up, but it simply fell apart when he did so, and nothing within it could be made into a pouch with what he had on him. In the end, he wound up securing the knife, spoon, flint, and steel striker together with the sports wrap, and using the long end to make it something of a necklace. It took a bit of finagling, and he wouldn't trust it if he had to run, but for the moment, it worked. Now armed, Terry reached the edge of the portion of the valley that was grass, and saw that the trees were gradually filling things in, but they seemed to be doing so only from the high end. Watching carefully for the carnivorous vine, as he advanced through the much younger trees, he finally made it to the water.
Probably going to catch some horrible parasite and die screaming from this, but since I'm already supposed to be dead and some monster's probably going to kill me way more dramatically in the next few days anyway, supposing I don't starve to death, fuck it. Bottoms up.
The river was crystal clear, cool, and tasted better than he ever remembered water tasting. Then again, he'd grown up drinking from the tap in a coal mining town. What did he know about good water? He leaned back, wiped his mouth, and took another long look around. There were birds calling throughout the forest, and though he could still smell the salt water, the air here also had a subtle flavor to it that gave him a strange feeling of nostalgia. He'd never been an outdoors type, but supposing he could make it through the next few days?
I'm really here. This isn't some fucked-up last-second dream I'm having, is it? Surely it wouldn't have lasted this long or been so unrelated to anything else I've ever experienced.
It was early afternoon now, and though he knew he was hungry, since he had no food, He drank again instead. It wasn't a good solution, but it was the best the situation allowed. There was bushy undergrowth here among the younger trees, but nothing that looked particularly edible. Not that he'd know what that looked like, even if it was staring him in the face. Outside of stumbling upon a conveniently labeled garden patch, the only edible plants he felt he had a decent shot at recognizing were strawberries, blackberries, or dandelions, which he knew had been brought to America as salad greens. Thank you, random wiki surfing. None of these readily recognizable edibles were anywhere in evidence, though. Picking up his spear, he followed the stream back toward the sound of a waterfall. The trees had hidden it from him thus far, but he'd been listening to the rumble of the cascade for some time. By the time he caught sight of it, the sound pretty much drowned out everything else. A low ridge about 40 feet high cut through the forest here, and the water of the river had cut a U-shape into the cliff and thundered down onto a cluster of boulders below. A rainbow danced in the spray, and the shadows behind the cascade suggested there was an amphitheater or cave beyond. The pool at the base of the falls was about 100 feet across and roughly circular. A single weeping willow stood just next to the outflow, its innumerable tendrils drooping down into the water. The foliage of the tree was vibrant and profuse, and some of the roots on the waterside looked to have been exposed by the gradual erosion of the bank. There was a rough, narrow strip of glacial sand ringing the pool, and beyond that, on all sides, was a veritable wall of shrubs and bracken, taking advantage of the hole in the canopy afforded by the water. As they spotted his presence, a small herd of deer drinking from the pool and grazing on the bushes nearby raised their heads and turned tail, fleeing into the forest on the far side of the pool.
That explains the loner from earlier. And since they were drinking, I'm pretty sure there isn't some monster in the pool waiting to snatch the life out of me. Go team.
He also realized that since the deer had startled and run away upon spotting him, they knew his shape and associated it with danger. This place wasn't the deepest, darkest forest where herbivores grew up, got old, and died without ever seeing a hunter. There were other humanoids nearby, the kind that ate meat. Part of him wanted to go behind the waterfall and explore, but again his native caution warned him against it. If he slipped and twisted his ankle, or worse, there'd be no hospital, no doctors, not even a friendly face anywhere. Instead, he approached the willow tree and warily brushed its tendrils aside with a spear. He'd already seen one seemingly harmless plant go murderous. He wasn't about to walk into another. Yet the willow tree gave no indication it wanted to eat him, and he slipped past its dangling tendrils and moved to the edge of the pool. A moment of study was all it took to learn there were fish in the pond, and he had a spear. He thought to fish, but realized that he had no idea what he'd do if he caught one. Even though he had the tools, he'd no idea how to start a fire to cook the thing, even if he had known how to clean it.
I really am probably going to starve to death in the midst of plenty. Why couldn't I have been obsessed with prepping for doomsday instead of beating the tar out of people? At least then I'd probably know how to start a fire and prepare a meal. Not like I can pummel or choke the nutrition out of my food.
Terry pressed his back to the willow tree and sagged until he came to rest. He put his new spear across his knees and leaned back, staring up through the branches of the willow. He didn't know what to do, or where to go, or how to find people he could trust. The giant woman with the horns had shouted that she didn't want to hurt him. The sea folk had said something similar, but they'd both given chase, and Terry had long since learned to pay more attention to what people did than what they said. The fish folk had gone so far as to spread word of his presence, and that had been all it had taken to put the village in a frenzy. He thought about it, and decided if he couldn't find a better alternative in the next few days, he'd go back down through the forest and submit himself to the people at the estuary. On the off chance they hadn't been lying, it would at least get him fed. Hot on the heels of that thought was another. He'd easily outrun his pursuit. Perhaps he could sneak into the village at night and steal food. thus getting what he needed without risking a confrontation or surrendering.
No, I'm not a thief. No matter how bad things get, I do things the right way. I work too hard to stay clean in body and clear of conscience to give up on it now. I'll bet Voight started out a self-justifying thieving little bastard, too.
The warmth of the dappled sunlight on his skin and the roar of the falls conspired to make him drowsy, and his eyes drifted closed as his focus fractured and was carried, along with all his worry, into slumber. Chapter 4. Are you serious? When Terry woke, it was all at once. There was no transition, no lazy half-sleep. One moment he was asleep, and the next he wasn't. His instincts warned him to remain still, and he did, cracking his eyes just enough to get a sense of his surroundings. He couldn't hear anything over the roar of the falls, and the scent of the water in the forest filled his nostrils. It was night. He had no idea what time of night, but there was a silvery glow beyond the veil of the willow branches that suggested the moon was up.
So what woke me?
Hunger, maybe? His stomach was tying itself in knots. But he put that aside as his eyes shifted, looking for something, anything that may have been the cause of his sudden awareness. It finally occurred to him that he couldn't feel the tree behind him, or the hard wood of the roots beneath his butt. Instead, his head was cushioned against something pliant, soft, and warm. With a startled lunge, he tried to get to his feet, but failed. Arms he hadn't realized were wrapped around his abdomen tightened reflexively, and he didn't have the leverage to escape. He wound up half-turned as his spear clattered away, and as soon as he realized he was grappled, he slipped his right arm under and behind, then over the shoulder of the person grabbing him. With a twist and a violent downward shove that elicited a cry of surprise and pain, he leveraged the arm attached to that shoulder away and out. He was released, staggered to his feet, then promptly tripped over the roots around him and fell backward into the water, which, as it turned out, was cold. Gasping, he got his feet under him and stood up, staring with wild eyes at the base of the tree and the person still seated there. The moonlight filtering through the leaves of the willow revealed a shapely woman clutching her left shoulder with her right hand. Her heart-shaped face was framed by a rich fall of hair and bore a mixture of surprise and pain. Shadows clung to her dusky skin, but it wasn't so dark that Terry had to wonder what she was wearing.
Nothing. No clothes. Not a stitch.
Her look of surprise turned to one of reproach as she asked,
"What did I do to deserve that?"
Her voice was melodious and had a breathy smoothness to it that reminded Terry of the woman who sang Smooth Operator. He was so taken by the sound of it that he was a long moment answering, and when he did manage to speak, he wasn't proud of what he said or how it came out.
"What were you? How did? What the fuck?"
She blinked at him, then smirked.
"I'm guessing you still don't realize just where you went to sleep. My name is Shy. I didn't mean to startle you, but you dozed off in my lap and I just wanted to make you more comfortable."
She gazed at him curiously as she said,
"I don't mean to pry, but are you a template? I've never actually seen one, but you fit the descriptions from stories I've heard."
Terry opened his mouth, then closed it as he thought through his answer and put it in the form of a complete sentence. Once he was confident he wouldn't sound like a moron, he said,
"I'm fairly certain I'd have noticed going to sleep in your lap, Ms. Shy. I went to sleep where you're sitting, but I'm sure you weren't there at the time."
She closed one eye and tilted her head a bit as she considered him thoughtfully, giving him the impression that she was trying to decide whether or not he was being serious. Then she stood up gracefully and took a step toward him. As soon as she did so, the willow tree vanished. One second it was there, and the next, not there. Without the shadows it had provided, He saw that she wasn't just dusky. Her skin was the same color as the bark of the willow tree. He could even see wood grain embedded in her flesh, as though it were a tattoo that covered her from head to foot. Her hair was the green of the willow leaves. Her eyes shone with a soft, silvery green radiance.
You are the tree?
She nodded, then lifted her hand to touch his cheek. He hastily stepped back out of her reach, then felt a flash of guilt at the hurt look that crossed her features. She lowered her hand and said,
Now you know what I am. What are you?
Human.
Is that your name? She asked.
He frowned.
No, my name is Terrence Mack. Human is what I am.
I know of no species by that name, Terrence Mack. I find that strange, considering you speak the common tongue.
Call me T-Mac, Terry, or just T. Calling me by my full name is weird.
She hesitated, then asked,
How did you get here, T?
As he thought about how to answer her question, Terry crouched and picked up his spear, which was half-submerged near his foot. He also checked the integrity of the bandage holding his meager supplies. Everything was, thankfully, intact. He then gave Shai a wide berth as he moved to get out of the water. It really was freezing, and he was soaked to the bone and starting to shiver. She watched him curiously, but didn't move to approach him again.
I don't actually know,
he admitted, setting the spear down and sitting on a sizable rock that had probably washed down from higher up.
I was at home, some things happened, and I woke up here.
He touched the scar tissue on his forehead as he said,
I'm pretty sure I'm supposed to be dead.
You were in a life-and-death fight? She asked.
Yeah.
She whistled appreciatively as she took a step toward him. His eyes flickered to the spear. She caught his glance and stopped, then slowly knelt, folding her feet underneath her and resting her hands on her thighs.
I'm not going to hurt you, T. If I wanted to, I could have done so earlier.
Yeah, I guess she could have. Sorry,
he muttered.
I'm not very trusting by nature. You're actually the first person that hasn't chased me since I got here.
No surprise there. Templates are exceedingly rare and highly sought after. If you were recognized as one, it is no surprise that you were chased.
Why does everyone keep calling me a template? Does that mean something different here than it does at home?
He asked. She tilted her head curiously and asked,
What does it mean to you?
He waved a hand aimlessly as he said,
A template is a framework. It's an outline without any substance, like a mold or a guide.
Shai nodded.
That's interesting, and not too far off the mark. Templates are believed to be members of the progenitor race, the basis for all the other races on Celestine. At any given time, there are only a handful of them in existence.
Terry held up a hand, then asked,
Celestine? I've heard that name before.
Shai nodded.
That's what this world is called by its inhabitants.
Okay. So why is everyone chasing me? Is there some sort of bounty?
A bounty? She laughed, tipping her head back and literally shaking with mirth. Terry blushed and turned his eyes away as he caught himself staring at the way her bountiful chest bounced while she did it.
That's just not fair. How's a man supposed to think with those on display?
When her rather musical laughter faded, she said,
There is no bounty, T. You're being chased because any who lay with you will gain mystic power and more. They don't want to capture you, dear man. They want relations with you.
What?
With some effort, he pulled his eyes away from her chest and met her gaze, as he mentally replayed what she'd said. With his eyes on her tits, he hadn't really been listening the first time around. Even when he was sure he'd heard her right, the only thing he could think to say was, "What?"
"Sex, not to put too fine a point on it."
Shai's smirk told him she knew why his mind hadn't kept up with the conversation, and heat suffused his cheeks as he glanced guiltily away.
"Well, shit."
Shai's expression faded from smug to somewhat confused, and after a moment's hesitation she said,
I'm sorry, are you homosexual?
Terry gave her an annoyed look and said,
No, I'm not. I'm also not a virgin, so don't ask. I happen to be pretty sure, therefore, that my cum doesn't cause superpowers.
She giggled at that and said,
You were also pretty sure you didn't go to sleep in a girl's lap, which you most certainly did. Your record for presumptive accuracy over the course of our conversation is on the low side.
Also out the window is the idea that a plant woman with the body of a porn star would use simple words, but I'm fairly sure telling her that won't do me any favors.
Instead, he said,
This place is weird. But I'm still pretty sure sex with me won't give you witchy powers you don't already have.
May I touch you? You are wary of me, and perhaps you should be. You're in a new place with new rules, and everyone here will want something from you. Other males will be jealous of you. Females of every stripe will desire you, and you are destined to lead a complicated life here on Celestine, presuming it is not cut short.
She arched an eyebrow at him as she said,
Which, unfortunately for you, is the likelier outcome. I offer you myself and my service. I will do what I can to ease your way should you accept me.
His eyes narrowed, and he took pains to look her in the eye as he said with frank cynicism,
What's in it for you?
She didn't look away, and her voice was steady as she said,
Perhaps quite a bit. Perhaps nothing at all. You sought me out, took comfort in my shade. I, in turn, took great joy in the act of sheltering you. And your being a template or not had nothing to do with it. You are the first person I've spoken with in half a century. You're odd and surprising, pleasing to look upon, and you whet my appetites in more than a simple carnal sense. You may indeed turn out to be a great disappointment to me, T, but I have a feeling about you. I trust my instincts, and right now my instincts are telling me that you need more than just my shelter. I'll give it to you, whether you lay with me or not. You have but to accept my offer.
It was tempting, terribly so. Terry had no one. He had no survival skills, and knew that he was staring death by any number of means in the face. He doubted that if he got killed here, he'd just pop up again somewhere else. This was a second chance he hadn't expected, and he couldn't afford to treat it like he'd get another one if he blew it. Still, he couldn't form a friendship based on a lie or a fable. His cynical nature was warning him that this was all a ploy of some sort, but for what, he couldn't imagine. The only thing he could think of was that she really believed that bullshit story about getting superpowers from fucking him.
I can at least clear that nonsense up easily enough. I need help,
he admitted.
I have nothing to offer you, though. If you think you'll get something out of having sex with me, I'm willing to at least do my best to make the experience a pleasant one. I have to admit that you've got a body straight out of fantasy. But again, I have to say, aside from what physical satisfaction I can give, I doubt there's anything in it for you. If you're unsatisfied, you're under no obligation to me. Sound fair?
Shai offered him a smile that was anything but shy.
T, did you just offer to give yourself to me, expecting nothing in return?
He laughed, but his teeth were chattering with the cold as he said,
Hell no. Didn't I just say you're pretty much the hottest girl I've ever seen? If you want me for my body, let me tell you, That's mutual. I might die in the next few days, but sex with you would be a good last memory.
She stood and reached out to him, pulling him into her embrace.